In this podcast, I'm going to talk about Kepler's law of orbits. Now, orbit is something that a planet or a body does about a sun or the moon does about the Earth. So you've got a central object, a massive object, and a much lighter object, which orbits around the outside of it. It's a bit more complicated if the objects are of the same mass or equal mass, but one's a much more massive object. And so that's setting the gravitational field, and the other one is just probing the gravitational field, orbiting it. Now, there's Kepler's three laws, which he published two, then a final one. But I'm going to talk about Kepler and his law, who he is, and stuff like that. The basic thing that I want you to take away is an easy rule of thumb to walk up to a situation and understand it. So if you increase... If you consider, you know, the orbit, the period of one orbit, 1 year for the Earth, at Earth radius from the Sun, you consider another radius at a greater distance, and the period of time for that new orbit will be proportionally bigger by that greater distance. Times the square root of the ratio of that distance. So let's go through that again. So if I double the orbit radius, I increase the period by double plus times the square root of 2 there. So if I have an orbit which is 4 times greater than the Earth, the orbital time there, the period there, will be 4 times the square root of 2, which is 2, 8 times as long. I think that's easy enough to remember. And I think when people start discussing the formulas, cubes and squares and stuff like that, it's easy to get confused. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. What I really want to do is later on get into dark matter, and this is sort of a foundation idea of how orbits are a probe of gravity. So the more massive an object is, for the same distance, the faster it, I think, will orbit around. So if something is a very light body, it will have a very slow orbit. So for instance, if you're in space and you just put a pebble in front of you, you'd have a gravitational field in front of that pebble, and it may take a year for that pebble to slowly orbit around your gravitational field. You've got a weak gravitational field, but if you're a black hole, you know, very massive, that pebble will race around you. So I can, from a distance with my telescope, read off gravitational fields by orbital velocities. That's a major insight that we're going to use down the track. So let's look at who Jonas, I don't know. Out here I don't speak to people, I only read stuff. Jonas Kepler. So let's go back. There was a theory based on the fact that the Earth feels stationary. If you're on Earth, it feels stationary. There's no winds, there's no indication that we're roaring through the heavens. It just feels still. Now, we understand why that is, but that came up with the original idea that the Earth is the centre of the universe. And now, strangely enough, when we go into special relativity, there's a little truth in that, but the Earth is the centre of the universe. And that the Sun and the Moon, the ancient belief is, if you're looking at it, obviously the Sun appears to be moving. Now, in, I think, Poland, there was a Copernicus, probably in Prague here, that area of Europe, there was someone called Copernicus, and he didn't necessarily have a mathematical reason to it, but he suggested the heliocentric universe, that the Sun is the centre of the universe. Well, there you go, we keep on. Now, the elusive centre of the universe, and that the Earth and various other things went on circular orbits, purely circular orbits around the outside. And there's problems with this in terms of this is not correct, but this is a tilt at the ancient belief that circles are perfect, the heavens are perfect, and circles are there. And it was seen that there's there, and that the surface of the sky was a starry orb. There was another circle out there with all the stars put on, and that was Copernicus. He had a student called Kepler, who's had a bit more of a mathematical bent to try and solve these problems. I think Kepler harked from Prague, I definitely know that. And Kepler went up to the great astronomer of the age, Tycho Brahe. He was also a one of these great showmen, sort of Carl Sagan, this person who in Denmark got a full 10% of the Danish economy funded to him to build fantastic astronomical castles in an island, I've got the name of the island, off Denmark, and he had a castle there. And Tycho Brahe, by all intents and purposes, was a classic Renaissance scientist, a bit of a genius, and he had the mechanical invention. Everyone else was using a wooden sextant. I don't quite understand how these basically an angle measurement. He had a brass one, and he was just really good at astronomy, really good at naked eye astronomy, looking at angles and times, and he built up a huge database of information, the mother load of information. And so you've got Copernicus, circles, Kepler, the sort of slightly more mathematical student. He goes over to Tycho. Tycho actually hoards his information, and there's a famous banquet. These banquets were pretty mad. There were dwarves and animals and secret tunnels in this place, and one of the things was that you weren't allowed to go to the toilet, and this meant that this not going to the toilet meant that Tycho Brahe, bear in mind, this person did not have a nose. He had a silver nose which he used to stick on, because back then there wasn't so much institutions. People would be roving scientists, and they would challenge people to scientific duels all the time. Now, in general, they were more structured civil events, but this particular scientific duel, I think it happened in Paris, this person lost his nose over some maths, and this is sort of really weird to understand, but as you read more into Renaissance scientists, that's how they operated. They would challenge other scientists to do things publicly, and letters, and there was no sort of, I suppose, referees or institutions or journals as we understand it. It was a more of an open Wild West. Okay, so in this Wild West, Tycho also had a moose. There's all these things that we, a pet moose, all these things that we hear of, and then people scratch through the archives and find letters of people referring to the basic information. So these letters are incomprehensible, but if you know he's got a pet moose, you can understand. So look, it's absolutely crazy, and Tycho Brahe can't go to the toilet, dies, and Kepler makes off with his calculations, his numbers, and uses the numbers to work out that to tweak everything else and to tweak the circular orbits into elliptical orbits, and without understanding gravity, work out that there's a law of things going through the ellipse, that things travel at different speeds as they go closer and further towards the sun. And he said they sweep up the same angle, some area of the ellipse, each period of time. So a long distance away from the focus, the sun is always at the focus. From the sun focus to a long distance away, you've got a long period of time, say a month, but that area, even though that's it doesn't move along the ellipse very far, the actual distance from the focus to the point of the ellipse is very long, and that's a greater area. And that's Kepler's law of periods, which translates into r cubed on t squared equals gm on pi squared, 4 pi squared. Now, I'll refer you back if you go into Dr. Hill Science News and go further back, you'll see an aide memoir for this. That's Kepler's Law of Periods, as you'll find it in your HSC or school formula sheet. And of course, you have to, the idea is we give you the formula, but you still have to understand how to apply it. I'll sort of go over the visual aid. I have a sugar cubed, a cube of sugar sitting above a teacup, a square teacup equals, I've got a General Motors pickup truck, a line and 4 square pies in a row. And if you go that, the sugar cubed, R cubed, so it's the sugar cubed, R cubed, over T squared equals GM over 4 pi squared. That's the way that I remember it. So essentially you've got the T on the left-hand side, you've got the T squared underneath, and on the right side you've got the M increasing. So looking at this, if you want to make both sides bigger for the same R, if you want to make both sides bigger, you can increase the M on the right side, or you can reduce the T on the left side, which is the fundamental view, the fundamental take-home message, is that I can look out into space, see a radius, see a period, and that measures the mass of it. So we can actually measure precisely the mass of Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, anything which has got a satellite around it, simply by looking at the moons going around it, and looking at the radius, working out the magnification, distance and radius that we're looking at it, and looking at the period, and that will give us the mass. So it's sort of like a cosmic mass scale, which I can look at. So that's the big take-home message. And then you've got the, so that's GM on pi squared, and it gives you a whole heaps of things. The big G there is the universal gravitational fudge factor, picked up by Newton. It's a number to make all this work. And it's a number that has gotten really... people are working towards the actual meaning of this number, or how to derive it, but this is a number plopped in from God, so to speak. God has given it. I think Newton actually believed that. Yeah, that was Newton's explanation. That's what number would God use? G. That's it, everybody. And of course, we are working away to try and work out what G is, that big G, not little g, on Earth, which is 9.8 meters per second downwards. That G is a formula number. It's got a method to, it's got the units of newtons, kilograms to the minus 2. So you multiply it by G by 2 masses. Those kilograms cancel out, and it just gives you newtons. That's the unit for it, that big G over there. So we've got on the left-hand side this sugar cubed on T squared, R cubed on T squared. But fundamentally, that means you can sort of work through that mathematically many times. But it means that if you go out to a larger radius, the actual circumference is proportional to that radius. So it's, if things were travelling at the same speed as Earth was travelling around its orbit at the same speed as Mars, and Mars was twice as far out, just for instance, so you've got the idea, that's a factor of 2. But Mars has got a lower gravitational field. So it's actually can travel, it's traveling slower because the gravitational field is less, because it has to, it's got a lower velocity, and the gravitational field is acceleration, which is that kick, that velocity kick. It's traveling in one direction, the velocity is in this, that travels, looking from above, it travels anti-clockwise. It's been kicked starting from 3 o'clock and traveling to 12 o'clock. It's been kicked leftwards, always towards the center rushing force. That means it can slow down. So if Mars is twice as far out, its period will be, the period of the time to complete one orbit will be 2 times the square root of 2. So if it's 3 times far out, period to orbit around will be 3 times the square root of 3. It's just so easy to get through. What happens is that your orbits basically map the gravitational field. And of course, there's no surprises ever in school science. Once you've got the central gravity, that works everywhere. Of course, this breaks down for galaxies, and there's a whole heap of amazing things going on. But for the Earth and the Sun, all this type of stuff, it's Kepler's law is on. So if it's farther out, it takes a longer time of farther out times the square root of farther out. And that's Kepler's law. So I hope in this we've gone through exactly who Kepler was, what he's discovered in terms of ellipses, his law, without going too much into the theory and getting you to have too much cognitive load, where he was in history. He was going from circles to data to fundamental law without understanding. Okay, Kepler did not understand gravity. In fact, Kepler, when you read his works, said that comets travel in a straight line, and they travel through space and they hit the fat globules in the ether. So he, when you really read into it, he got certain things right, but there are other things which are full-on consistent with the general idea of the starry sphere out there and everything going on. He got one aspect of it, he was in his time, so to speak. So again, he believed that comets didn't travel in this elliptical path, and he believed in ether, and I don't understand what these flat globules are. So we've got that, and you got your formula, but in general you might be asked to make a few calculations and apply this formula, but you can instantly, rule of thumb, the multiplier factor for the radius, and then you just whack in the square root of that to get the period. Okay, well, thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science and definitely thinking science, and just confidently think for yourself and work your way through. That's definitely what I've done. Bye for now.